So, the mic is on. We are winning. As you may or may not be able to see, there has been a little bit of a hitch and a change of plan, but we're going to have a different sort of conversation, touching base with some of the original ideas as we go along. We are very, very grateful to Maggie Hambling having stepped in this afternoon to have a conversation with Martin Shaw. I'll say a little bit about each person, and then I will vamoose, and we'll hear what they've got to say. Yeah. A little bit difficult to do. That's all right. Okay, Martin Shaw is a writer, mythologist, and storyteller. Author of the award-winning Mythteller Cycle, recent books have included The Night Wages, Wolf Milk, Courting the Dawn, Poems of Lorca. He's also creator of The Living Myth, and oral tradition programs at Stanford University, and he spent 4 years living on a succession of English hills, exploring remaining pockets of British wilderness, which sounds pretty amazing. As I was preparing to come up this afternoon, I was told by several people that Maggie Hambling needs no introduction, but I have a tiny one. So, renowned sculptor and artist, one of the greatest living British artists. At the moment, we're thinking that the Roar Requiem installation could well still be on at Snape, so do get down there. And if you have not yet seen the installation, the sculpture Scallop on the Aldborough Beach, you need to see it now. And if you've seen it before, see it again. Please welcome Martin Shaw and Maggie Hambling.
Hello, can you hear me? Am I coming out of the tannoy? So I want to say just for a moment something about the woman on my left. I know Maggie's work really is just a supreme painter, a painter that just continues to deepen whatever she's up to at the time. So thank you so much for rocking up. Thank you so much for doing this. It's deeply appreciated and a beautiful thing. So look, we were meant to be talking about the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner with Dame Gillian Beer. Now, Gillian is the authority on that poem, not myself. So I was hoping to just sort of add the occasional vignette to whatever it is she had to say. But many of you will know the poem. It begins with three guys at a wedding. Sounds like the beginning of a joke. And a bright-eyed old man pulling one of them aside and saying, "I have a story to tell you." And next door, you can hear that the wedding's in full swing. And he's saying, "Look, I don't have time for the story." And he says, "You're going to have time for my story." And this mariner, who is a kind of storyteller, sits the lad down and tells him this extraordinary voyage that he went on, this redemptive, terrifying, shamanic, initiatory journey way out to sea, way out with the event with the albatross, way out for feeling utterly forgotten by God or the gods, and then redeemed again, and somehow coming back after this big, deep journey, able to tell a tale. What I like about the poem is at the end, the mariner says, "I don't tell this story to everybody. Every now and then I see somebody and I know this is for you." And I was lucky enough to be at Maggie's studio yesterday. And as I looked around, I thought, oh, this is a lot of deep sea treasure. This is a woman that knows a lot about journeying out into unexpected and wild places. So a question that I had is simply, what got you started?
Well, literature got me started.
Oh.
Because at my first school in Hadley, where I grew up, the other side of Suffolk, Uncle Tom's Cabin was read to us. I think I was about 8 or something. And the fashion was, in those arithmetic books with squares in, to make patterns, you know, with more and more exotic crayons. You know, if you had a gold crayon, you were really in.
Yeah.
And so that's what, as things were read to us, that's what we did. But I actually listened to Uncle Tom's Cabin, and it is largely about the treatment of slaves and slaves being beaten and dressed. And so I sat there trying to draw the slaves being beaten. Yeah. But before that, I realised I did it the wrong way around. Before that, Oscar Wilde had come into my life much earlier, sort of 5 or 6, when at that same school, his stories for children were read to us. And there was this voice from another place, I mean, to me, like from another planet, you know, taking one into that place of the imagination compared with the sort of, you know, young farmers, young conservatives, I mean, what one was surrounded with. Mm. I mean, there was this extraordinary voice which took me into the imagination for the first time. So that had happened first, and that's literature, and then the Uncle Tom's Cabin, and that's literature. So it's really literature that made me start doing all this.
Did you, as you were growing, did you ever think about being something else other than an artist?
Do you want the honest answer?
Yeah.
Well, you won't believe this. But the home setup was quite strange, and my father was quite a lot of the time out of the house. And so I attempted to keep my mother amused, you know, to make her laugh and the rest of it. And so I thought, obviously, the only thing I'm going to be able to do is to go on the stage. As having sort of acted for most of my... Anyway, and so my father said, well, there's no point in you going on the stage. We all know you can act, but you can't dance and sing. Very rude, I thought, because I think I can dance extremely well, and I can't sing. But he said, you know, you go on the stage, you've got to, you know, you've got to be able to dance and sing and do everything. And then at the age of 14... which was a great shock to me. I came top in an art exam because I'd done nothing but flick paint at people and draw attention to myself because I was deeply in love with the biology mistress who was invigilating the exam, right? And then suddenly the clock said 3:20. I thought, oh, fuck, I've got to do a painting before 3:30. So I did one, and when the results came out, I was top of art. So I thought, this is interesting, you know, very must look into this, you know, you don't have to try and you're good at it. You know? So that was really where it all began. And so, and the art mistress, she lived around here, she was called Yvonne Drury, she was a practicing painter, took me on one side and said, look, if you go on the stage, if you're very lucky, you might work 1 month in a year, whereas if I think you're an artist, and however poor you are, you can always afford a bit of paper and a pencil. So that made sense.
It seems these days there's quite a few young artists in Suffolk. Were there many?
Well, everywhere you look, there's another artist in Suffolk.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a wonderful cartoon in one of those magazines that comes round about a year ago, and there were two rats one side of the street, and the other side of the street it said art gallery. And one rat said to the other rat, that's the trouble with Suffolk these days, you're always within 4 feet of an artist. And it's true, they're coming here like lemmings. Used to be just Constable and me, but now they're everywhere. Like air plants, you know, they're just everywhere. Yeah. Anyway, that's enough of me, go on.
Well, no, I love...
How did you start doing what you do?
Well, I grew up in Devon, in the early 70s, and we were, in a way, quite a poor family. So we didn't have a car, we didn't have a television, we didn't have a phone. But we had a lot of books. And I had a mum and dad, who I still have, who were... They loved language. They loved the spoken word. My dad's a kind of wild kind of preacher. My mum's a painter. And one way or another, whenever we got a couple of quid as a family, the thing that we did was buy more books or records. So in a way, there was a lot of culture in the house. There was a big old forest behind the house where we were growing up, and I spent most of my time scuttling around this forest, as you could as a kid in those days. It's extraordinary. I mean, I can remember from the age of five, I was at large. I was just at large. I could have gone anywhere. There was no phone. There was nothing. I just disappeared like Tarzan into the tree line with an understanding at some point I would be hungry and I would return. And most of the time, I did. But I grew up around stories. I had the strangest experience when I went out for an early morning walk with my dad, and it was dark. And as we were walking, my dad's only 19 years older than me, so he's still he's a youthful dad, still in his 60s. As we were walking, he recited by heart, and this was the important bit, by heart, the whole of a poem called Sohrab and Rustum by William Arnold. Now, as my dad is just speaking this incredible language, the sun comes up. It was so well coordinated. When you're four, you think your dad's act of speech just made that happen. And my dad did not correct me on this. He said, well, son, you know, I'm connected. And then that night, I noticed that when my mum was reading me stories, the moon would come out. So in some odd way, it seemed that speech and stories were a way you could reach out and bump into trees and animals and dreams and the dead and all of that stuff. So that got me started. But then, as you do as a teenager, I temporarily forgot all about it. And then when I was in my early 20s and I started to go through all the sort of, you know, divorces, misfortunes, illnesses that people do, I went...
How many divorces have you had in your 20s?
It's endless. It's endless. I got started young, you know.
I'm getting quite nervous.
I know, well. I've been waiting for this moment, Maggie. You know.
You'll be lucky.
I remembered the stories that I loved as a kid. And I realised that these stories of mythologies and legends and the rest of it, they were far subtler than I'd realised when I was six. And they were speaking about all sorts of travails I was going through as an older person. So I decided to study them, read about them and tell them. But that's what got me started in a way was catastrophe, you know, an ordinary catastrophe. So did you go to art college in London? Did you move out from Suffolk?
Well, I left school halfway through A-level and went to Ipswich Art School for a couple of years.
Yeah,
but before that, I'd taken my first paintings under my arm to show Lett and Cedric Morris and Lett Haynes, who ran the East Anglian School on the edge of Hadley. And I took my first two oil paintings there when I was 15. And it was a summer evening and I banged on the door and Lett came to the door, and Lett was very tall and I suppose quite frightening. And I said, is Sir Cedric Morris at home, please? And he said, Cedric Morris is having his dinner. So I said, well, may I wait? You see, having sort of got the courage to go there, my parents needed some kind of encouragement. It was a good idea, and I just said I was going to try to be an artist. And so I thought, well, I'll take my paintings to show Cedric. And anyway, so Cedric was very... I went in, and he was at the end of a long table, and Lett was bringing him all these extraordinary dishes for dinner. I mean, like, it was 1960, and in things like couscous. I mean, who ate couscous in 1960? I mean, he was a very exotic cook. Anyway, so Cedric was very giggly and fine and friendly. And then when he'd finished his dinner, he said, well, put them up there on that storage sheet. And I put the paintings up there. And he was encouraging, he made criticisms. And then Lett wandered back in the room and made entirely the opposite criticisms. It was also very encouraging and said, well, I suppose you're still at school. And I said, yes. He said, well, come along and paint with the students in the holidays. So the first day of the holidays, I was there, but I was too nervous to go up the drive and go into the house. Yeah. So I sat in the ditch at the end of the drive and painted the ditch. Then I, you know, was encouraged into the house, and I worked with Lett in the kitchen. Everything I did was wrong, but anyway, I worked with him in the kitchen, and I painted, and it was Lett who said the most important thing to me that anyone ever said, which was, if you're going to be an artist, you must make your work your best friend, that you can go to it whatever you're feeling. You know, you're tired, you're miserable, you're happy, you're sad, you're randy, whatever you are, go to your work and have a conversation with it. And that is how I've lived my life. And the other thing he said, which I'm sure is very mutual ground for us, is nobody can be an artist unless they have imagination. Mm. So those two things are really what I live by.
At that age, who were the artists that were most alive for you? Who did you get excited by?
Well, I know that I'd sent off to somewhere or other for some prints of Picasso that I put on my bedroom walls. I mean, my bedroom had sort of become my studio by then, obviously, and whatever went on in the rest of the house, I would go to the bedroom, the studio, and try to paint the truth, because then the rest of the house felt like a bit of a charade, okay? Things being covered up. So that was where I went and tried to paint or draw the truth. And I remember having Picasso around the walls. Then when I went to Lesson Cedric, and then obviously Ipswich Art School, and then Camberwell, and then the Slade. I mean, it was the 60s. I was a student in London in the 60s. Uh-huh. And I do remember it. So a bit of a failure, really. I mean, I did see the Beatles at the Gobots in Ipswich when they had those haircuts and those suits, and everybody was screaming and fainting, and I couldn't scream or faint. So I thought there was something wrong with me. But that's right. Where were we?
We were thinking about painters that you were excited about at that time. Remembered Picasso.
But then did see a great show of Rembrandt at the Royal Academy. I think I was still at Ipswich, and somehow I saw this, and that was it, really. Yeah.
Was there a moment in your painting life where suddenly there was a particular break and you thought, right, I'm going to be able to just do this all the time now? Or was it something that was incremental? And bit by bit.
Well, I did it all the time from the age of 14.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I stayed with, my mother paid for me to go and stay with Yvonne Drury, who lived at Curtin on the way to Felixstowe, to learn about oil paint. And it was very, very hot. Mm. And these insects were everywhere. Insects sticking to the painting, sticking to the palette, sticking to the blah, blah, blah. And she wandered across the field to see what I was doing, and I said, what am I going to do? Insects are sticking to everything. What can I do? What can I do? And she said, well, there's only one thing to do, have a cigarette. So from the moment I had oil paint in my hands, I had a cigarette. I'd be better now if I had a cigarette in my hands. And I'm sure if there was a Noel Card play on this stage at the moment, they'd all be smoking, but apparently I'm not allowed to. And your turn.
Can you think of something to ask me?
Have you ever smoked, Martin?
You know what? I've never had a cigarette. But it feels imminent now, doesn't it? But no, I didn't. Because my dad, oddly, who was not a sort of didactic character, he just said this one thing early on. He said, I do love the fags. Himself, he said, there's the greatest smell, but he said, I'd like you not to smoke. Now, what he should have done is given quite a few other decrees at that point as well, but he forgot. So I led quite the life for a long time, but the one thing I didn't do was have a fag. However, I have had cigars on occasion, which I have thoroughly enjoyed.
What about the wacky back here?
None.
I mean, you have the appearance of someone who might once upon a time. I mean, even David Cameron,
it's
I believe.
True. It's true. There, I would imagine both of us at this moment in time look like we've just wandered in and we're on our way somewhere else. There have been psychedelic edges to my existence on occasion, but actually no, none of it kicked in. I think that my great love actually is whiskey.
Oh well,
and that has provided me with such deep sustenance that for now at least I don't need to wander far from those pastures. Although we had a chat about special brew, didn't we, a minute ago? Do you remember special brew? Yes, and we were saying, apparently, is it Carling or Carlsberg? Yeah.
You didn't know that it was invented for Winston Churchill?
No. Who knew?
Did any of you know that special brew was invented for Winston Churchill? Well, you see, you're here to learn. Winston Churchill was invited to the Carlsberg Brewery. Oh. And they knew he liked champagne, they knew he liked brandy, and they invented special brew for him. And he took to it like a duck to water and had it sent over to England. And Jonathan Reakey told me that it was invented in the 50s. And Jonathan Reakey told me that when, in the 50s, special brew appeared, Benjamin Britten took to it like a duck to water as well. So I have very good antecedents in the drinking of special brew, which is never advertised.
No.
But I'm doing my best here now. So how does the imagination come into your work? You see, I say that because I happen to hear a bit of Russell T. Davis's Desert Island Discs on Friday morning, and he said this thing that made a lot of sense to me. He said that one moment of the imagination was worth a lifetime of experience, and I understood exactly what he meant by that.
That's a brilliant question. Where does the imagination come into my work? Well, it seems to be that for thousands and thousands of years, when human beings imagine, they often imagine in images or stories. And one of the frightening things about being the particular type of storyteller that I am is that I can't work to a prescriptive description of anything. I can only learn the bones of the story, but the actual job at hand is to reimagine it in public. So that lacks some of the smoothness that other storytellers can give you. But I have to see it. I have to see it and describe what I'm seeing as an act of imagination to keep it fresh and alive to me. And the moment I stop doing that, the moment it becomes more like a recital, it goes a bit flat for me. So it's always something of a tightrope act. And the frightening part of it is always about half an hour before you're doing it, because this kind of dreaded blankness comes over you. It's like you've never had a bloody thought in your head. You can't remember the stories you're going to tell. Any wittiness has long departed. I had a friendship, though, with an American poet called Robert Bly. And I used to sit on stage with Bly, and he'd do his thing, and it was dazzling. But he once took me aside, and he said, look, he said, all you're seeing is the 10 minutes a day that I'm creative all stuck together. He said, there's 10 minutes here, there's 10 minutes here, there's 10 minutes here, there's 10 minutes here, there's 10 minutes here. I've compressed it into an hour and a half, and it's not bad. But he said, that's what it is. So for me, until I'm in a hot spot like this, certain synapses in my head don't connect. I can't do an enormous amount of work for a story in the study. I can do research, but the real thing actually happens in an encounter like this. And so
why don't you tell that one of your stories, the one about the fox? Foxy Lady.
A Foxy Lady? All right, I'll tell a Foxy Lady story. Okay. Once upon a time, it was the end of the day and there was a hunter coming back, trudging through the forest, and he had empty hands. The problem with being a hunter is, you know, the job description is in the name, and he hadn't hunted anything. But as he came back to his hut, he saw something that really chilled him. He saw a thin column of blue smoke coming from the hut chimney. It meant someone was in there. So he slows his pace. He pads over to the snow to the door, looks through the door, and he can see that there's a pot of stew, and he can see that some clothes have been sewn up and attended to. Now, this is just a young guy, and no one has ever been that gracious to him before. No one's looked after him like that. All week long, same thing happens. Till finally, I'm surprised he hadn't done this earlier, he comes home a little early. He's not the sharpest pencil in the pack, you know. And he comes in, and this is what he sees. He sees that there's seemingly a woman in the hut. She is stirring the stew. She's singing over the stew as she cooks in some kind of language it's hard for us to understand anymore. There's a great river of hair down her back. And in the way a hunter knows, he can tell that this is part woman, part spirit, part fox. And she can tell, in the way all women can tell, that she's being watched. So she turns round, flamenco stamp on the floor, and she says, "I will be the woman of this hut." And he looks at her and he says, yeah, he knows a good thing. That first night between them, God Almighty, we're all a little jealous of it. They sit down, the mood is sweet. It turns out she knows a lot of jokes. It turns out he knows a lot of songs. They've got 1,000 things in common. It's a lovely scene in the hut. But you will know that all fox women have a pelt. They have their fox pelt. And the place that she wanted to have her pelt was just hanging off the door at the front of the hut. So inside the hut, there's the pelt. Now, I can tell that this is a rather rural audience, and some of you will know that a fox pelt can give off a very pungent scent. Foxes give off a scent at particular times of the year. And they have their big love affair, and it's a wonderful thing. But after a while, the scent of the pelt is just filling the hut. It is everywhere. It's in the hunter's clothes. It feels like it's in his food. It feels like it's got in his traps. It's everywhere. So one night when they're sitting down and they're eating together, he says, "Oh, bright pulse of my whole understanding, sky woman of the dawn, there's just this one thing. I adore you. We're in this forever. But the smell of your pelt is so overwhelming. Would you consider not burning it, not disowning it, just moving it outside the main house? It could hang from a tree. We could go and visit the pelt. I could make you another pelt." But it's a very, very strong experience in the hut. And she looks at him, and it's as if he said nothing. She just ignores it. 3 months pass, and now, if the scent was bad before, he's losing his freaking mind, you know. He's just losing his mind. And he got some of those special brews we'd been talking about. It was dangerous can number 3. He was on can number 3, and he said, "Look, I told you before, get rid of the fucking pelt." And when he woke in the morning, the fox woman had gone, the pelt had gone, the scent had gone. And they say and say truly, to this day, the hunter stands in the doorway of the hut lonely in his whole body for the scent of the fox woman. Bless you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, the strange thing about that in terms of the imagination is if you see that story on a page, it's about three paragraphs long. There's nothing there, really. There's just the bones. You know, there's Hunter. It's very easy to skip over it. But something happens when you tell it. We had a workshop here yesterday with a few folks, most of whom I hadn't met. And really, the first thing we did was, rather than have me pontificating on for hours and hours, was just to tell stories like that and get them telling them. To find out that when you tell a story like that, you surprise yourself. There is some part of your imagination. I mean, say there's 50, 60 people in this room. There's now 50, 60 slightly different versions of the fox woman. We all saw it a different way. And I like that. I think that's good. It keeps it alive for me. So that's part of my feeling about imagination and painting. I mean, and storytelling. And what about you? Where does imagination come in with your work?
Well, for instance, some people here may have been to the War Requiem installation in the Dovecot at Snape. I mean, I didn't look at any photographs of war victims. I didn't look at any photographs of battlefields. The whole lot came from the imagination, right? Mm. A lot of my work takes place when I'm asleep in bed, the great thing about dreaming about a painting or whatever it is I'm working on is in the dream, it all goes absolutely marvelously. It resolves itself. It's a masterpiece. Then, of course, you have to get up in the morning and it's not quite like that. But, you know, it can suddenly... And these sort of moments, like with Scollop, for instance, there was all the business of trying to get the money together to make the thing, right? And, you know, I suppose we'd begun to get a bit of money together to make it. And I was lying on the beach here at Aldborough on a sunny afternoon and evening, and I looked up into the sky, and we all know you can see faces and everything you want in clouds, blah, blah, blah. But suddenly these two clouds got together and they became this bird shape that was rather like Scollop. These two clouds got together, became the shape like a wonderful, triumphant flying bird. And at that moment, something said to me, "You're going to do it. You're going to make it. Whatever anybody else thinks, you're going to do it." And I knew at that moment it was going to work, even though we'd only got a couple of grand or something towards the money it took to make. Mm. You know, those moments happen and they give you some kind of faith in something.
Yeah. You remind me of in fairy tales, if you're lost in the forest, often the only thing you have, think of something like Hansel and Gretel, the only thing you have to keep you going is your little drop. You'll find a little bit of plum cake here and there, a little nibble. And you just start to follow the trail of this small thing. And the further you go with it, your fidelity to these little nibbles get you where, you know, Blake would say they get you to Jerusalem's wall in the end. But you've got to be, you can't be sizist. You've got to be aware that it might be a very small thing that takes your curiosity. And you just stick with it and stick with it and stick with it. And then suddenly there's a story. But trouble is, when I was younger, I was always waiting for an eagle to land when I was lost in the forest and say, "Your real name is Sweetgrass Man." But that oddly didn't show up. But then one day when I'd got over the eagle, I'd noticed there'd be a little bit of plum cake, an idea, a thought, a whimsy. The stories that I tell are always stories that trouble me into communication. There's always a bit in it that I don't like or sticks in the craw or is like a pebble in my shoe, and that's when I know that I've got to tell it. There's stories... I mean, thinking about The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. One of the things that's been said about this huge poem is that it turned out to be very prophetic in Coleridge's life. So he writes it as a young guy. He writes it, he's never been to sea. He'd never been to sea. He's 25 years old. Even Wordsworth, at the beginning, regards it as slightly beyond the pale. So 20 years later, as a middle-aged man, he writes a little glossary next to the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And in a way, that's one of the most fascinating things for me, is, I guess it, in a way, it's like talking about a painting or a piece of work you made 2 decades ago. What's your relationship been like with that piece of work ever since? So Coleridge's gloss of the Mariner, his explanation of the Mariner, has a kind of maturity in it that comes with having lived with the bloody thing you created for the last 20 years. And theoretically, there's a lot of argument that he then lived through a lot of the experiences in that poem. In other words, it was what you call a prophetic poem rather than a pastoral poem. It's not reassuring. It kind of cracks things open. I notice we have about 15 minutes left. Shall we turn to our assembled...
Have you got
any questions, basically?
Yeah.
It's a question to both of you about your relationship with the sea. And Martin, you have a lot of stories with forests in. Do you have any with the sea in? And Maggie... Can you hear?
And it's a little low for me, so if you could just...
What did I just say? Do you have any stories with the sea in? Because there's forests in a lot of your stories and wolves. And to Maggie, the image that's on the screen there... And
out of focus, don't look at it.
Okay.
Go and see the real painting in the Time and Tide Museum in Great Yarmouth. Even though that's in Norfolk, apparently.
I will do when I can. But could you say something about your about your stories of the sea? It's sea stories.
Good question. I grew up by the sea. I was thinking about this morning. I grew up in Torquay, in Devon. So the sea and venturing out to sea was a big thing for me when I was small. I could barely swim, but what I really wanted to do was swim in the autumn and the winter, which was seemed a little peculiar for a 6 or 7 year old. And I couldn't swim far out, nothing. I wasn't a strong swimmer until I got goggles and a snorkel, and then it was a different game. But I do know stories of the sea. I know a lot of Inuit stories of the sea, a lot of stories of Sedna. To harp on about Coleridge for a second, you should really read an essay called The Snake and the Oak by Ted Hughes, where he argues that Coleridge was really conversant with sort of Greenland shamanism around the time that he wrote the poem, and that he almost scares himself about halfway through and then moves back into a more sort of redemptive Christian arc. But actually, the stuff that I know about the sea, the material I know about the sea, is very old, archaic Inuit stories. Now, people ask me sometimes, what gives you the right to tell those stories? The reason I have the right to tell them is that the world is on fire. And I spend a lot of time with what you would call, you know, indigenous elders. And I was with a guy called Larian fairly recently, whose culture really is around the Bering Strait between Alaska and Siberia. And I asked him about a few stories that I told. And I said, do you mind me telling them? And he said, if you don't tell them, who the hell's going to tell them? We don't tell them. We don't tell them. So usually the price tag involved for me, which I willingly pay and have paid for 2 decades, is that I make sure on my travels... especially when I'm in America, I'm in, you know, what you call indigenous or Native American communities, and we share stories. It's a far less inflammatory thing to do than you might expect. So actually, I do have stories about the sea, and they tend to be, Sedna stories, Inuit stories. Over to you, boss.
Well, it's out there, you know.
It's out there, yeah.
And it's quite big.
Big?
And I have wondered if I make my sea paintings because I can't swim. So I'm terrified to death of it, all right? No. When I was a toddler and I was taken to Frinton, and I'd walk into the sea and talk to it. I mean, God knows what I said to it. Mm. And I can't remember it answering me at all. But anyway, apparently I'd walk into the sea and talk, as if the sea were my best friend. But now, as I'm slightly older, I remain silent, and with luck, the sea talks to me. But it's a very private conversation.
I see.
Mostly about terror and death, you know. Cheerful!
Have we got another one?
Okay. I'll come back to you. Just a little literary link that I'm kind of throwing at Maggie, that she's a bit like J. Alfred Prufrock, who heard the mermaids singing in the sea, but I didn't think that they will sing to me. Martin, you told me yesterday that you know and admire the work of Tom Lowenstein, who is one of the great experts on the Inuit and lived with them.
Yes.
Did you also know that more recently he wrote a very strange thing where he imagines that he is Coleridge wandering around the Quantock Hills, dirtying his britches, among other things? And I don't know whether Tom Lowenstein knows that Coleridge had an interest in the Inuit, which is how amazing things join up together.
Yes, that's a brilliant bit of synchronicity, yeah. That this is even happening at this moment. Yeah. So you know Tom, don't you?
Yeah.
So please just relay that to him.
Yeah.
And send him to a book by Ted Hughes called Winter Pollen.
Yeah.
Occasionally, that's where it is. It's a really thick essay at the back. Yeah. It could be a small book. And it's secreted in there, Coleridge's relationship to what Hughes calls Greenland wizards.
Excellent. Yeah. Wonderful how things connect up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Martin, the blurb online for this tour mentioned the role of rhyming and breath in revealing a story, and I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about that, particularly about the breath, which kind of intrigued me.
The breath?
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about spending a little bit of time with the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is the fact that it rhymes. And as someone that reads a lot of modern poetry, I started to get the giggles because it bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub-bub. It's got a tempo in it. Now, my background, how I entered living for a long time, was as a drummer. So I think in time signatures. I think in patterns. And there is something that happens with when different rhythms introduce themselves onto the breath. I remember years ago, I was in the Villa Borghese in Italy, and I got to see, I had an amazing, there was a double bill where one night there was Patti Smith, and the next night there was something called the Master Musicians of Djajouka, who were these trance musicians from Morocco. And they played certain rhythms for about an hour, and not much happens. And they had an old man with them. They had a kind of a medicine man whose only job was to identify when Pan had arrived. And he sat at the end, and he was smoking. And he's smoking, and he's in his suit, drifting in and out of reverie. And for no reason that I could decipher, after an hour of drumming, he just went, ah! Like that. Pan had arrived. The moment he did it, two dogs that were in the crowd just fucking launched at each other and fought in the dust. So the old man is suddenly up and moving. The musicians are playing. The dogs are fighting, and Pan has arrived. And that taught me something about rhythm. It taught me something about breathing. One of the greatest storytellers we have is a very senior figure called Hugh Lupton. I don't know if you know Hugh Lupton. Check out Hugh Lupton, because Hugh doesn't do what I do, which is all kind of Dick Turpin, stand and deliver, haven't got a thought in my head. Hugh recites it. So there's another kind of storytelling that the Sufis would call a visionary recital. So in other words, you know where the pressure points are. You're going to go back to that again and again and again. Some storytellers, you could say, are like ceremonial magicians, and they deal with parameters. They always go to the same places. They build it in a very structured way. Whereas the more shamanic end of the thing traffics in improvisation. That's what it's doing. I'm more attracted to that, but I admire the other kind too. That's the only thing I can say about breath. But a good question. Thank you.
Do you have any thoughts about the awful national curriculum to which our children are subjected, and anything that we can do about it? And do you do anything about it?
I'm afraid children aren't my field. Over to you.
Yeah, I do something about it. I am a single dad, you know, raising a 14-year-old girl. And it seems, I would suggest, we're living at a point where girls are told that they have no voice, and most boys I know are ashamed to become men. That seems to be the deal right now. So in my own little way, what I do is I go round and I try and tell the stories you would traditionally tell a young woman when she was at that rocky bit between adolescence and young womanhood. And I do the same thing for young men, young boys. And traditionally, the way that I've done that for the last two decades now, last 20 years, is to take them to a remote region, which in our world, would Snowdonia will qualify as that. Dartmoor National Park will qualify as that. And for a period of time, they are rather vulnerable. They are not surrounded by gadgets. They're not surrounded by smartphones. They're not surrounded by their peer group. They have a fire. They have stories. And they then go out into the forest and spend a little bit of time on their own. And they have me as base camp to sit there and bear witness to them when they come back with their, they don't want to do it, but they come back with these fragile little stories. And what I do, I naturally do, is when people tell me a tale, what I hear is the fairy tale behind the story. That's kind of what I'm trained to do, I think, organically. So a lot of my life is listening to young kids and hearing the bigger story behind their story, and then actually just telling it back to them. Not like a guru, there's nothing creepy in it. It's just a very simple thing that you raise them up. Years ago, the first really great storyteller I ever saw was a Lakota Sioux medicine man called Wallace Black Elk. His grandfather wrote Black Elk Speaks, which is a very important book. But Wallace said this to me. He said, tell me about the work you want to do. And I told it to him. And he said, can corn grow from it? What will grow from what you're doing? And then another teacher, another friend of his, said this. He said, are you around younger people? And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, find something they're doing and praise it. Make sure it's specific, not general. Because with young kids, and if they admire you, if you don't find a way to praise them, you hurt them. So that's all I can say, I'm afraid, about any national curriculum, but that's my bit of it.
And are you really sort of talking about people at school being using all these, not just using their smartphone thingies all the time and playing those games on the television rather than playing hockey or something healthy, out of doors, get them out of doors. I mean, rather than doing all that, I mean, at school it's more and more technical, isn't it? And they, they're encouraged to be people who sort of work with computers and that kind of rubbish, aren't they? And not perhaps they're not read Oscar Wilde's children's stories or Uncle Tom's Cabin, or I mean, they're encouraged, I think, I don't know at all, but they're more, surely people are more encouraged to the sciences, aren't they, than the arts.
I would imagine.
I think, but I don't know.
The point is, imagination in schools is not valued.
Yeah.
That was really the basis.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've been talking essentially about the use of the imagination.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do know in art, I have seen some school children's work in which they're encouraged to copy things, you know, for art. They're not no longer saying, you know, paint a painting of your mother having a picnic or something. They're copying something, you know, out of a comic or something, which is the absolute death of everything. Sorry, I interrupted you.
I'm sorry, I've had a sign down here. This needs to... Very quick, and then we'll come here, and then that's the end.
Maggie, you might be interested in a school report I had from the art teacher, who said, Alwyn is too imaginative. And my parents had the grace to be amused.
Well, I got the lowest possible pass mark at O level for art. I got 45%. If I got 44, I would have failed. Shows just how important exams are.
Exactly right.
We've got a final question here.
Hello, Martin. My question is, you mentioned about the world on fire.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit more about how you see the link between storytelling as an act of eco-activism?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have to repeat a couple. There's a few people here will have heard me. You could practically chant along with me at this point in terms of what I'm going to say. I'm interested. There's this odd thing that happens with ancient stories, some of them, not all of them, but some of them, where there'll be a moment in the story where you suddenly realise, God Almighty, this isn't a story about the earth. This is a story that the earth is speaking through. There's almost an act of mediumship within the story. And for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, until very recently, all over the world, people used stories to cross-pollinate information between us and what David Abram calls the more than human world. So there are intelligences within stories. There's perspectives in stories that aren't even human. Therefore, I can't help but believe that a large part of the reason we're in the state we are now is that we have willfully detuned our ear to that. Therefore, what I'm trying to do in my own life, and I encourage everybody to do it, is find ways to retune your ear. A great thing about being a storyteller is that it sounds so benign. You can get in anywhere as a storyteller. I have been in the most extraordinary people. Now, don't ever call yourself a shamanic practitioner. Don't ever call yourself a wizard. Don't ever just dial it down. Dial it down. Because nobody has ever said this in the history of creation. If there's one thing I just bloody can't stand, it's a really good story. No one says it. So I use that as my cloak to get in and then do my work. But that's what I think it is. I think there was a time when words were like magic. That's what the Inuit say. There was a time when words were like magic. And actually, I spent 4 years living in a tent wandering around what remains of the English wilderness. That kind of old information, that kind of relationship is not as far away as you may believe. The problem is returning to an environment that has amnesia or active hostility to it. So what I've been doing with my life is using stories to come in like smoke and get that information across. All right.
Well done.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bless you.
Let's thank Martin and Maggie for producing such a wonderful, fascinating, unexpected conversation about the imagination, about our practice, and about what we can do and carry into the world. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.